The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 27, 2017. After another week of crashes, including the high-profile death of world champion moto racer Nicky Hayden, who died 5 days after being hit by a car while training on his bike, it would be nice to have a quiet week of National Bike Month. Can we just have that, please? I hope so. Let's move on with this week's show because it's a good one. We have three guests this evening, three very diverse topics. We begin with one of the most talented frame builders working in the industry today, Tyler Evans, along with his other three compatriots, Jamie Medeiros, Kevin Wolfson, and Daniel Leader. Tyler leads the Firefly team out of Boston to produce some of the most exquisite titanium bikes available today. Some of their innovations in finishing the material, as well as adding artistically inspired graphics, makes their titanium bike stand out in a world of, well, titanium. After we leave Tyler and take a break, I speak with someone who rides 16 hours a day in 4-hour shifts, 7 days a week, and is about to set a world record around the world in 80 days. It's an 18,000-mile trip. Mark Beaumont, who began riding long distances at the age of 12 when he rode across Scotland, has never lost the drive to go far and go fast. Mark joins me from the Highlands of Scotland in between one of his training sessions to talk about his riding, his philanthropy, and the incredible support he gets on all of these adventures. Then we end this episode of The Outspoken Cyclist with Jeff Horowitz. Jeff's new book, Ageless Strength, Strong and Fit for a Lifetime, is a simple recipe for anyone, especially those who haven't kept up with a strengthening program. He emphasizes three basics, balance, strength, and functionality, and explains how you can get all three in a focused 1 hour per week. His philosophy makes a lot of sense and gives you a way to look at exercise from a different perspective. So off to Boston we go to speak with Tyler Evans. Hello, Tyler. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. So I've heard a lot about you. I also read a lot about your company in, what's that called, 73? I think that's the name of the book that came out of England.
Yeah.
What a beautiful book, huh?
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah. And you were featured quite well in that book, I must say.
Yeah. They did an excellent job representing everybody in that. They did a story on in there. That was really fun.
It was fun. So tell us a little bit about Tyler's background and how you became interested in bicycles.
Well, I have a background mostly in sculpture. So I got my degree in sculpture, but while in school, I, of course, was into cycling as well ever since I was a kid. And it became my primary mode of transportation once I came to Boston to go to school. And then I started getting into more of the sport aspect of it and mountain biking and road biking and all that. And also at the same time, I was doing a lot of blacksmithing and metal casting and welding and all that. And I found out that there was a frame builder in the area, which is Merlin Metalworks. So I went to go apply for a job there, eventually got it, and started welding pretty much right away. And that was back in 1993. So I started in Merlin. Actually, I started Merlin in 95. I was a bicycle mechanic in 1993, working my way towards figuring out exactly what aspect of the industry I wanted to be in. So I started there, welding titanium, and really fell in love with titanium as a material to work with.
Were you the person who came up with the Newsboy?
No. I think that was Rob Vandermark.
Isn't that a cool bike? That was a cool bike.
Yeah, that was a fun bike. I welded a few of those, though, back in the day. Sorry about this phone ringing.
That's okay. Let it ring. It's not a problem. Let's talk a little bit about Firefly. How'd you come up with the name for the company?
Well, we had lots of names in the works. We had a long list of potential names going on. And then one day, Jamie and his wife were on a road trip, and they were also thinking of names, my partner Jamie and the company, thinking of a bunch of different names. And then one of them was on the list was Firefly, and he came back to me with that at first. I was like, oh, I don't know. And then sort of went back through the list, added it to the list, and kept going over it. And that one really stood out as a name. And I approached my friend that has a marketing company, ID29, in upstate New York, and talked to them about the names and the design of the everything we wanted to do. And they sort of took us under their wing and helped us out trying to get the whole branding together. And they took the word Firefly and sort of incorporated it into the logos of the bikes and the head badge of the bikes and all the branding, and gave us a real good lesson on branding too.
It's a great name. You know, you don't think Firefly, you don't think bicycles, but yet it stands out, as you said. So you personally have created, it says, now you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think so, thousands of frames.
Yeah.
I think that's so cool that you can say you have thousands of frames under your belt.
Oh, yeah. By the time we started Firefly, I already had about 10,000 frames that I'd worked on.
Wow.
Mostly talking about the welding end of things.
Yeah, so, sure.
But then it moved on to all sorts of different aspects of frame building. So.
Yeah, I know you're an artist. You're not going to be happy with just one thing. You do deliver a very stunning variety of titanium. And I know you do a tie-in carbon and you do one steel frame. That's a special project.
Yeah.
How did you land on titanium as the metal of choice for you?
Well, titanium is sort of the natural choice for us. I mean, I was always very fluent in that as sort of my first frame building material to work with. And then when we decided on what to make our bikes out of, it sort of stood out in terms of like durability, corrosion resistance, and strength. And also it sort of has that natural beauty of the metal, and the welds are very smooth and nice when done properly. And the fact that it's raw and you don't have to paint it is also a really nice option, you know, a really nice feature of the material. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff that we do where we get into our finishes and things that are very true to the material. And I don't know, it's just a wonderful material to work with. And there's a lot of tubing available in different wall thicknesses and diameters. So it's just great material to work with. Another thing about it is there's a lot of value packed into titanium as a material. It just is around forever. It's very strong. It lasts forever. It's light, has a very nice performance characteristic. So it just seems like the best material to make a bicycle out of in metal, maybe even in any material. Carbon is wonderful in its own way too, but there's just something about the liveliness of the titanium that is really unlike any other metal.
I'm partial to titanium. You don't have to convince me, but I hope the listeners can understand your excitement about it. I happen to like titanium too. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Tyler Evans. He is one of the partners at Firefly Bicycles out in Boston, Massachusetts. So you alluded to some of your finishes, and a lot of people would say, oh, I don't want titanium. All titanium looks alike. Firefly titanium does not necessarily look like other titanium. I might even call some of your finishes sexy. So tell us a little bit about some of your finishes, the kinds of things you've done with titanium that you don't see from other builders.
Yeah, well, in terms of finishing and just working the metal to create a different texture or surface, we'll do brushing, which creates sort of a grain structure on the surface. And try to make that nice and even. There's polishing, which is basically like reflective. Bead blasting, which we shoot spherical media at the frame, and it creates sort of a very sort of almost matte, like slightly textured surface. Very satin look to it, very even looking. And then we also do anodization, which is a thin oxide layer that we form on the surface of material that refracts the light and sort of bends the light waves. So you look at it and you see different colors depending on the thickness of the oxide layer that we put on there. And all those things by themselves are sort of very plain and regular, but what we like to do is mix them and match them in certain ways. And that's really where our design and conversations about design come in between ourselves and our customers. So we develop complex masking systems with various vinyls and then use those to isolate the different surface finishes. And so we can do that in very intricate ways or in very graphic, bold ways, subtle ways, and just like pretty much anything, any sort of possible way you could think of combining these different finishes we can do.
So all of these finishes, I take it, you do in-house?
We do it all in-house, yes.
Yeah. How long would it, you say, and I know this is going to be one of those, well, it could be a minute, it could be 10 days. What would the average frame taking two or three of those ideas and sort of once you've decided what it is, you and your client, how long would it take to finish a frame like that? Let's say the frame is built. I take it all these finishes go on after the frames are built.
Right. A typical finish is anywhere from 1 to 3 days per bike. And that, of course, depends on the complexity of the finish. So a simple one won't even take a whole day. But then some of the more complex ones we've done have taken up to 3 days of work.
Well, this didn't occur to me till right now. But when I think of finishing a bike, of course, metal, steel needs to be painted. These other finishes are long lasting. You don't have to finish them again. Do they don't come off in any way? Do they wear down in any way? Do they stay the same like titanium? You just kind of buff it out again.
Right. So they're very durable finishes. They are the metal itself. So if you could take like sandpaper to it and scratch it, it's going to look like sandpaper scratched it afterwards. But I mean, if you did that to paint, it would be kind of devastating to the paint job. But in any, if you think about it, you can really bring the bike back to its original finish. We're only manipulating the metal, just the surface of the metal. And it's usually just a matter of buffing it out with some Scotch-Brite if it needs to be cleaned up, or re-blasting an area if that area was already blasted, things like that. So it's a super durable finish. You're not harming the surface in any way. And it's pretty much the lightest finish you could ever imagine, just because it's literally nothing.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's
cool.
Not like you're adding a whole bunch of stuff to it, like a coat of
Correct.
Paint. Right. I get it. I know that you are a photographer, you're a sculptor, you're a graphic designer. How have those things, as you brought them to bicycles, influenced your designs? What do you see in the art side of you that has influenced the sort of mechanic side of you?
It almost encompasses every aspect of my life, inside and outside of work. At work, it's sort of, we've used it to encompass the entire, like our entire business model and marketing strategy and everything. The best way to think about it is everything we do is documented throughout the entire process of building the bicycle. So we approach everything we do in a way that it's going to be seen. One thing we do is we try to bring the customer sort of into the process of building the bike through photography. Not just all the bikes we build, but specifically their bicycle. So we'll be sending them pictures along the way and showing them the bike at different stages of being built. And then at the very end, we'll do a photo shoot of the whole completed bicycle. And that does a few things. One of them, it sort of keeps us on our game constantly. And it provides like a visual documentation with the customer that brings them into the process. And then it's constantly creating new marketing material for us. So we have a constant flow of images coming out of the shop, which is pretty awesome for us because we're a very small company, but we're trying to make sort of a larger impact with our images and our design. So
one of the things that really interested me as you look through the gallery on your website is that you actually don't give your bikes model names. Now, you can ask for a road bike, you can ask for a cross bike, you can ask for a mountain bike. And yet you number your bike. So it's FF followed by whatever the number of the bike is. I take it that's the serial number of the bike?
That is, yep. And then we do them in order. So you can see that we've made over 650 bikes since we started. And everybody that gets their bike sort of takes pride in their serial number. And
oh, sure.
Use it sort of as a hashtag in whenever they talk about a ride they're doing or their bike. So you can sort of follow each bike through Instagram and other social media things, just from the customers themselves putting the bike out there, which is kind of fun.
What a cool marketing idea. I like it so much better than this is a, XYZ bike. I love that.
Yeah, and the fun thing about not having actual models is we have basic categories like road, mountain, cross, all-road, utility, and those are all sort of starting points
right. That
lead to a deeper conversation of intended use. And that's what we're always trying to get at, is intended use, because every bike we do is custom and every person is different and everybody rides their bike in a different way or has goals. And through conversation, we can try to match the bike to the goals of the individual and the riding style, their body type, their fitness level, their hopes for the future in terms of fitness and rides they plan on doing. So just getting to the point of that conversation is the main thing. And then we use those sort of basic things such as road, mountain, cross, all road as sort of a basic category so people have an idea of the direction they want to go. And it just helps guide the conversation through many of the different options that are available.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Tyler Evans. He is one of the owners of Firefly Bicycles in Boston. You know, this brings up sort of a thought for me about the difference between a client who might come to Firefly and a client who says, oh, I have one of these, meaning one of the big brands with the name and I want the kit to match and all of that. Who is your typical customer? Who is the person who would prefer, and they might have a Madone in their garage, but they mm-hmm. want a Firefly. What is it that they want?
It's generally a rider that has ridden a lot of bicycles. Most of our clients are very experienced. A lot of them are looking for titanium sort of specifically, and they look at what we do, and they have great faith in our abilities to produce what they want. But they're generally pretty smart cyclists, which is really great. We have a lot of designers that come our way, which we've sort of attracted through our photography and our graphics and all that, which is also great. So we get to have a conversation about not only the bike. When Kevin is one of the founders here as well, and he does all the fittings and customer interaction, and he has the conversations that lead to the general design of the bicycle, the geometry, the tube selection, and he has the beginning conversation about a lot of the graphics, and then I usually take it from there afterwards and start figuring out the actual scheme for each one. And it's great having conversations with a lot of these people, a lot of architects, graphic designers, photographers, all and engineers, like all sort of coming together and trying to like realize their, I don't know, a bicycle that matches their personality in a way in terms of finish. And that's pretty fun.
That's really interesting sort of clientele, sort of a category, that one that I hadn't even thought of when I think about who our clients were. They were a little bit different. They all had exactly the same kind of hopes and desires for their bike, but they're coming mm-hmm. at it a little differently. So I can really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Are you seeing any trends right now with the frames? Are people asking for something different from, say, they asked for a year ago or 5 years ago?
I would say that we're calling it the all-road market.
Yeah.
I think that is growing the most. It's sort of like a bike designed for more adventure and getting people out into places that they may off the paved road and out into the countryside a little bit more, or like something that's a bike that's a little bit more prepared for anything, because people seem like they leave their house now and they're trying to escape in a way, or they're trying to find some head time and they don't know where they're going to necessarily end up. They might be sick of the same road loop or sick of the same mountain bike loop, and they just want to go and find a route out there, or just sort of find an adventure. And it seems like larger diameter tires, sort of a road bike platform for the most part, disc brake, maybe some more rack mounts and some sort of racks for some other utility style items on the bike, extra water bottle cages, things like that. Bikes that are being really set up for adventure. And the cool thing is titanium is really well suited for that, just especially through durability and customization.
So let me ask the question I ask everybody who builds bikes. How do you feel about road discs?
I'm 100% for it.
Wow. Very interesting. Not everybody says that.
Yeah, I think, in my opinion, I think they have better, more reliable stopping power throughout various conditions, and essentially like more power with more sensitive modulation. And I think that results in less hand fatigue and more control overall.
What about the forks?
There's a lot of forks available. They all work very well. There's tons of offsets, build heights, customizations on them for like different fender mounts and rack mounts, and everything's evolved pretty well now. And I think it's all really evening out and everything's working really well, which is the main thing.
Well, that was an issue. And from what I'm hearing, see, I don't have a lot of experience with discs yet. The hydraulic brakes seem to be the ones people are sort of trending toward right now, too.
Yeah, yeah. And I come from more, in terms of cycling, I come from more of a mountain bike background. And I was sold like 10 years ago.
Okay.
You know, in terms of performance. And also, you know, you don't have to worry about truing your rim all the time. And it's just,
no, but you do have rotor issues occasionally.
Yeah, I don't really.
No. Well, no, I mean, not you.
Yeah.
All right. I have another question. What's the most out of ordinary? What's the most extraordinary frame you've ever built? Something really weird and different. It could be size. It could be type. It could be whatever.
Well, last year we built a bike for a client out in San Francisco. Basically an electric bike, an electric assist bike.
Nice.
With a Bosch motor that we had to get in from Germany. And they wanted everything pretty much hidden on the bike. So all the electronics and all of the brakes and all the different wires for the lighting systems, and everything was all run internally. And it was a step-through frame, and it was all these interesting bent tubes. It was quite the project. It took a while. So we were off and on working on this project for a few months as parts were coming in, as we ran into issues and had to consult lots of different people. So that was a very fun project, and it turned out great. So
well, that was going to be my question, and how did that work out?
it was surprising. Like, I knew it was going to be interesting to ride, but I just didn't realize how much fun it was going to be to ride. So after the photo shoot, we were finally able to really take it out and give it a good test ride, and it was super fun.
What's the biggest frame you've ever made? I'd go for smallest, but I know that you can sort of achieve small with wheels and some other things, but big, you only really can get up to either a 29er or something like that these days.
Yeah. So biggest one, like back in the Merlin days, we built a frame for Dennis Rodman.
Okay.
basketball player.
Yeah.
He's not the tallest guy that I've ever built a bike for. Definitely built some bikes for people over 7 foot. I think he was like 6'8" or 7 or something like that. So he was very tall. But that was back in the days when sloping top tubes weren't really something that people did much of. So you had to build sort of a horizontal top tube on a road bike. And the fact that it was horizontal, in order to get his hands in the right place, of course, the head tube was very long, but that the top tube sort of came horizontally off of the head tube and resulted in a seat tube length of 72, which is just huge.
Huge.
So I could put the frame down, touch the bottom bracket to the floor, and just straddle the top tube with my leg. Like, it was right there. And it was definitely the biggest frame. It might not be for the biggest person, because you can get longer top tubes. But if we're measuring just like the one that seems like it was like the tallest frame, that was definitely it.
We have a 6'8" viola player here at the Cleveland Orchestra who, strangely enough, while he's an avid cyclist, or at least was, isn't riding as big a bike as you might think. So I understand about having a large frame for a person who may not be the tallest person that you ever built a frame for. So what's the lead time for a Firefly frame these days?
Right now it's at about 14 months.
Wow, you guys are booked up.
It's been slowly growing. Yeah, and our output has increased a little bit too, but it's just been slowly growing. It hasn't been like out of control growth. It's just been slow and steady. And it's been fine. Luckily, people are still willing to wait that long. But as we get better, it sort of evens out a little bit at times. But there is a demand for it.
Well, as you said before, people who are buying a Firefly frame probably have another bike to ride while they're waiting. They're not.
Yeah,
this isn't
cases,
their first
yeah,
bike.
Yeah.
This isn't their only bike, right? So, what does Tyler like to do when he isn't taking pictures or building bikes or sitting at your computer designing stuff? Do you do anything else in the whole world?
I do. Well, I just had a daughter like 1 year ago last
Congratulations.
Week, and I'm really enjoying being a dad with her. It's really fun. This whole last year has just been an amazing learning experience for me and my wife. We've just been having so much fun. So I really enjoy showing her the world. And then when grandma comes to town or something, or we get a babysitter, it's really nice for me and my wife to go out, and we go mountain biking together quite a bit. And then just at the end of every day, it's just really nice to sit down at dinner with the family and just talk about our days and have a few glasses of wine and make a nice meal. And that's the main stuff, a little bit of gardening here and there and some travel, but mostly just hanging out with my wife and my daughter are the main things I enjoy.
Well, that leads me to my last three questions. I ask them to everybody. What's your favorite food?
I'm going to say tacos.
Okay.
And that's a broad, it sounds like a pretty specific, but it's actually quite general. There's so much you can do with them. So I enjoy finding cool tacos and making cool tacos.
Okay. Well, if you cook at all, you know, you're okay in my book. What kind of music do you like?
I'm going to say, I'll be extra general about that and say, because there's just so much variety that I listen to. But
right.
In the shop, I like the music really loud just because the machines are kind of loud. So it's kind of, you really need to find music that works really well at a higher volume. And then at home, a little bit more subdued and mellow.
And do you and your wife and your little girl have any pets?
Yes, we do. We have four cats.
That's a herd.
It is. It's a little herd. But I mean, it's very interesting. You'd think it would be crazier in the house, but it's almost like you don't even know they're there. They slink around, and they're very sweet.
Cats are good. They're good. So I do have one more question, which has nothing to do with food, music, or pets. Will you be at the Builder's Ball?
I will be at the Builder's Ball, yes.
Well, then I will see you there.
Cool. Looking forward to it.
Well, I had to promise that I'd be there this year because I've sort of turned it down the last couple of years, and now I am having my feet held to the fire. So my husband and I will be there. I know we're going to have so much fun, and we're coming to Boston. Well, Tyler, thank you so much for spending time talking with me today. Maybe when we get to Boston, we'll come see Firefly. We'll just come in and you know, take a look around. Would that be okay with you?
Oh, yeah. We'll give you a tour.
That would be awesome. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful evening. And go have a taco.
Awesome. Will do.
All right.
Thanks.
So much, Diane. Okay. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tyler Evans joined me from the Firefly Bicycles offices in Boston. You can see some of the amazing frames, learn more about Tyler, Jamie, Kevin, and Daniel's work, and learn about their histories at fireflybicycles.com. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back to talk about riding around the world with ultra-distance cyclist Mark Beaumont. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We are going to head over the pond and speak with Mark Beaumont about his upcoming 80-day record-breaking attempt as he goes round the world on a bicycle. Hello, Mark. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, actually, you're not here. You're there. You're over in the UK. What's going on there today?
I'm in the Highlands of Scotland, so... Yeah, if you've seen Brave, it's up in that territory. I've just got off my bike, actually. I've been out for a beautiful ride today. It's wall-to-wall sunshine, pretty mountainous, as you might imagine, and I'm building the miles because I'm going back to cycle around the world. I've done it before, and I'm doing it again, 18,000 miles against the clock.
It's unbelievable. The number of miles just is mind-boggling. What kind of bike do you ride?
It's an out-and-out race bike. I mean, it's got to be super comfortable. So it's a carbon race bike. It's a Koga frame. I'm riding electronic DI2, disc, you know, hydraulic brakes. It's a pretty racy setup, but I'm on the bike 16 hours a day. So it's got to be that compromise between speed and comfort. You know, you can't ride big miles. You can't ride 230, 240 miles a day if you're not comfortable. So, I've built it over the last couple of years to perfectly set up for these huge miles.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm 34, and I've been riding my bike pretty seriously since I was a 12-year-old kid when I pedaled across Scotland.
Yeah, tell me about that first bicycle adventure of yours.
Well, I grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere in the mountains, and I read in the local newspaper about a guy who had cycled all the way from the top of Scotland to the bottom of England, which I guess in US terms is not very far, but it's 1,000 miles, and I wanted to do it. So I took this plan to my mom and dad. They said, well, considering you've not really cycled off the farm before, why don't you try something smaller first? So I got a friend and we cycled across Scotland, which was only about 150 miles, but I was a 12-year-old kid. And these ideas just got bigger and bigger. So by the time I graduated from university, I was ready to set out and cycle around the world, which was, you know, an 18,000-mile journey. And that really set me on the path for what I'm doing now. That was, you know, just over 10 years ago. And that was my first big world record and the first time I'd made a TV documentary. And yeah, I've been riding my bike and breaking records ever since.
So you never lost that desire to do these insanely long-distance rides?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where that came from. It's not like my family's particularly sporty, but I've always enjoyed doing the ultra distances, and I've always enjoyed going fast. I'd be a hopeless nomadic traveler. I mean, I've got loads of friends who just go out on their bike and tour and explore the world at a wonderfully bumbling pace, but that's not me. I've always been in a hurry. So the flip side of that is I've never raced. I've never gone shoulder to shoulder and actually seen how fast I am in a normal road race. You know, my type of sort of record breaking has always been about going out and taking on these vast distances. So the last record I broke was the length of Africa, Cairo to Cape Town, 6,000 miles through places like, you know, the Sahara Desert, the Ethiopian Highlands, you know, the great savannas of Botswana, Tanzania. I mean, these are awesome landscapes to ride your bike. Another ride I did a number of years ago was Alaska, Tierra del Fuego, which is, you know, 13,000 miles down the length of the Rockies and the Andes. And the whole point in that ride was to basically try and ride the mountain ridge from North to South America. And I got off the bike to climb Denali and Aconcagua en route. So those are the sort of challenges I enjoy.
Yeah, they're a little crazy to most people, but I can tell that you just probably thrive on it. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's great fun. I mean, I'm lucky to have incredible support around me. I mean, I'm now, you know, married. I've got two beautiful daughters, and the heart of my little enterprise is still my family. You know, my mum works with me full time. She's what I call base camp. She's always pouring over the maps and making sure the team know what they're doing. So it's, yeah, I'm out there pushing the big miles and making TV documentaries. But at the heart, I've got an amazing family who just sort of keep me on the road and you know, back me on these big journeys.
So they do travel with you then?
Oh no, my family are mainly back here in Scotland.
Oh, they are.
They do come out. I mean, that's why I call mum base camp. You know, she's coordinating things from afar. Having said that, I do try and bring my family on as many adventures as I can. My 3-year-old daughter's been to 15 countries because, you know, whenever I try and get, you know, to an exciting place, I fly them out. But they're not cycling with me. I'm going a bit fast for that.
Yeah, so I want to know how somebody stays in the saddle for 240 miles, 16 hours a day. I mean, it is unfathomable to me how you can keep your ass on that saddle for that length of time.
So, I mean, my routine at the moment, what I'm training for is the alarm goes off at 3:30 in the morning. I'm on the bike at 4. I ride 4 times 4-hour sets a day, so I'm riding 16 hours. I finish up at 9:30 at night. You know, I go to sleep at 10:30 and then the alarm goes 5 hours later, 3:30, and I'm back on the bike at 4. So that's how you ride 16 hours a day. If you ride at an average of 15 miles an hour, that's about 240 miles a day. Obviously, if you've got a tailwind, you can go further. If you've got a headwind, you go slower.
That's true.
Yeah, it's just a bit of practice. I mean, it's something I've been doing for 20 years. It's something I've built up towards. The big difference between a lot of the riding I've done years ago and what I'm up to now is I used to do sort of proper wildman style bike packing, you know, just with frame bags and going ultralight. Whereas now I've got a full support team. You cannot ride 240 miles a day for weeks on end if you're carrying kit. You know, I'm stripped down racing. I'm going as light as possible. And I've got an RV. I've got a motorhome behind me supporting me. This is sort of Tour de France style, as opposed to the old days where, you know, I've spent over a year of my life living in a tent. I'm not doing that anymore. This is all about performance.
Let's talk a little bit about how these events are supported financially, because you give a lot back to philanthropic causes. You're called a business ambassador. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the heart of what I do is I'm a bike rider and a broadcaster. I make films and I hopefully, you know, inspire a generation to get out there and push themselves. You don't need to be riding a bike, hopefully, to take inspiration from journeys like this. I mean, for example, my ambition this year is to get around the world in 80 days. Wouldn't it be cool if, you know, on a bicycle, you could, by manpower, get around the world in 80 days? But, you know, by sharing that journey, I'd love for people to reflect, hey, what's my 80 days? Like, what does that look like in my world? So there's a whole educational program off the back of what I do, you know, shared through schools internationally, where they learn about the places I'm going, and they learn about the bike, you know, all sorts of other core subjects like math and art. But, you know, the wider impact, I hope, is just people, young people, being given the confidence to live out their dreams. In terms of, you know, the funding and the business side of what I do, you know, I've got an incredible group of backers now, sponsors who buy into these ambitions, like Panaracer and Altura and Koga. They're some of the guys who are backing me in terms of this specific bike kit. And these guys just love the scale of the ambitions I take on, you know, and the fact that I managed to share, you know, I'm not racing in a traditional sense of the world, but I'm going out there and I'm exploring the world and hopefully, you know, showing what's possible. So I mean, my world in terms of broadcast is hopefully sharing these journeys with young people, with children through schools in an interesting way. But also, I tell you one thing, people love to be involved in the success of these journeys, but it's very hard to get people to buy into the dreams at the start. You know, when you're saying, I think this is possible, and then people go, really? Well, let's just see. And they sit back and they wait and see. So it's, you know, even with a good track record, it's tough to get people to buy into these ambitions. So it's amazing when you do get people to do that and you get that real fit. Because the records I break, I tend not to pit them by a day or two. I tend to take them to a whole other level. The Africa World record I broke by 18 days. The Around the World record this year I'm trying to break by 43 days. You know, these are leaps in performance, and they're really taking endurance to the next level. And yes, it's exciting to share those journeys, but it takes ambitious people to buy into that level of ambition.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Mark Beaumont. He is about to embark. I think you're leaving July 2nd, as I remember.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he's leaving on an 80-day journey. So it's interesting that you picked 80 days. I remember growing up seeing a movie called Round the World in 80 Days, and the guy who I remember was in it was David Niven, who was a British person, and he was wonderful in those days, and it was by hot air balloon.
Yeah, I mean, the original Around the World in 80 Days back in the 1870s is a wonderful story. Phileas Fogg. It captured the imagination of generations of children since then. You know, this was an eccentric Englishman from London who was in his club in London called the Reform Club, and he got bet by his friends that he couldn't get around the world in 80 days. And so they gave him a wager, they gave him a bet, which was an incredible amount of money. I mean, in modern money, it would be the equivalent of £2 million sterling. So that's a lot of money. And it's an amazing story about how he then took trains, planes, hot air balloons around the world. So if you go to almost anywhere on the planet, people have heard of the story of Around the World in 80 Days. So it's an idea which captures the imagination. And you know what? It might just be possible. Could you actually get around the world under your own power in 80 days?
It looks like it's going to be possible. So I want to move on to talk about Orchid Studio. The last adventure you did, which was a record-breaking adventure that was in Africa, ended up doing something with kids and something called Orchid Studio. Tell us about it.
So Orchid Studio is the name of a charity and organization that I've helped grow over the years. Orchid Studio literally stands for Orphan Kid Studio. And because it's a group of architects who create buildings which become the heart of communities, healthcare centers, orphanages, all sorts of places to help children and young people. So the money that we raised when I raced the length of Africa and broke that world record has helped build a very large healthcare center hospital on the Zambia DCR border, which is an incredible legacy from the back of a project which is just a guy cycling the length of that beautiful continent. So, I mean, I've worked with the Orchid Studio team over the last 10 years, and I'm incredibly proud how the work we do and the broadcast and the fundraising, you know, directly impacts to thousands and thousands of children on the ground in parts of the world where, you know, they just don't have that luck. I was born in a part of the world where I've got the freedom to live out these dreams and get on my bike and go on journeys. We can't all do that. But through these journeys and world records, you know, myself and my team do have the ability to give back. Orchid Studio is really grassroots. You know, it's really a small organization which has incredible impact. So, you know, I'm very proud to continue to work with them.
Well, I know that you have lots on your plate today, and I would like to ask you to give our listeners a way to both follow your new journey, find out more about you, and maybe help support the Orchid Studio organization.
Absolutely. Well, it's an exciting time to get involved if you've never heard of Mark Beaumont before, because I'm off to cycle around the world, and if I can get around the world in 80 days, that's a piece of history right there. So online, if you go to ArtemisWorldCycle.com, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, it's just at Mr. Mark Beaumont. If you're on Strava or Facebook or any of the other accounts, you'll easily find me. Just look up Mark Beaumont, and it all kicks off from Paris on July the 2nd. If I get around the world in 80 days, I should get back to Paris around September 16th.
Well, we will be watching. We will post all that information. Lots of luck. Have a wonderful time and go fast.
Thank you. Look forward to speaking again.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Mark Beaumont joined me in between training sessions. You can follow Mark's 18,000-mile record attempt, which begins July 2nd, at markbeaumontonthebike.com. We're going to take another real quick break. We'll come back to speak with author, coach, and personal trainer Jeff Horowitz about his new book, Ageless Strength, Strong and Fit for a Lifetime.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back, and as promised, we're heading down to Washington, D.C. to speak with Jeff Horowitz to learn about how to get into the best shape of your life. I'm ready. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. There's been a lot of conversation about your new book, Ageless Strength, Strong and Fit for a Lifetime, and I think it's going to help a lot of people. Most of my listeners and most of my yoga students fit this kind of age group that we're sort of aiming at here. Tell us a bit about your background and how you came to write this book.
Well, I've been around fitness for, it's scary to say, about 3 decades now, probably a little bit more than that, but professionally for 3 decades. Came to it kind of slowly. It was a second career, then it became a full-time career. But more than that, it's been a passion. So I've been running marathons, well, since 1987. I just did my 186th. So this has been a big focus of my life. And as I get older, I realize I can't quite do the things that I used to be able to do. But thinking about how we age and how we can maintain fitness, there was a lot that I was able to learn both through practice and research and application. And much of what I found is that a lot of the problems that we always assumed would be part of getting older aren't necessarily inevitable. So, for example, losing one's balance, losing strength, losing functionality, becoming fragile, these things happen mostly through inactivity. And actually, if we focus on meeting these challenges, as I call them in Ageless Strength, then for many people, we can achieve the best shape of our lives, even into our later middle age and beyond.
Well, what's interesting is if this is a picture of you on the front of the book, it looks like you're 30 at the most.
Thanks. A lot of people have been asking me that, but that's not me on the front of the book. I am inside the book.
Oh.
And you'll see my photo inside the back cover. But, you know, it's very interesting. Those two athletes, even they are, I met them. I was there with the photo shoot, and I participated as well. They're not much younger than I am.
I was going to say, you still don't look that old, Jeff.
Well, thanks. There's some mornings that I feel the difference, but, you know, as I like to say, I could still do everything that I used to do, and I may not be able to do it quite as fast as I was able to do 20 or 30 years ago. I may need a little bit more recovery, but thankfully, I could still participate in life in all the ways that I've wanted to. And I think that's the key. That's what most of us of a certain age really want. Not necessarily the big beach show muscles, not to bench press a certain amount of weight, but really just to live our lives now in a, you know, a comfortable, fun, adventurous way. And that's what I aim to help people attain with this book.
Well, one of the things that you bring up right at the beginning of the book is how quickly a body, any body, can regain balance and strength and function. And I see this with my yoga students. You know, they'll come in, they'll say, oh, I'm so stiff. I can't do this. I can't do that. But very quickly, after a few yoga classes, you'll see that body beginning to come back to a younger form, if you want to call it that. So tell us why you think people believe or are led to believe that these things are going to become like unattainable, that we can't get our balance back, we can't get our function and our strength back. Why are people told this?
I think it comes from an age-old approach to aging, which is that as we get older, we should settle down and start acting our age, start cutting back on the kind of things we do, leave it to younger people, you know, act like an adult, act like a senior citizen, act your age. And once you start doing that, once you start curtailing your activity, it becomes a downward spiral. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you stop doing these adventurous things, if you stop using your body, you know, every day, then your body gets weaker and you start losing your balance. You lose some strength. You lose some functionality. And that fear becomes your reality. Now I think things are changing. We're all part now of a generation that doesn't necessarily accept that. You keep hearing about professional athletes and amateur athletes and even our friends and neighbors who want to do things that our parents and grandparents never would have thought of doing. I was just talking this morning with a friend of mine about how at my age now, and I'm 52, which I hope isn't that old, but
it's
I have
not.
Memories of my parents being my age. And, you know, in my memory, they just seem so much older than how I am now. I think about the things they did and the way they lived their lives at this point. And it's not at all how I approach things, where I bicycle every day with my son and I go to the gym and I just finished a marathon last week, as a matter of fact. And it's just about your approach to life. But you raise an interesting point about how quickly you can turn this around. And as I explain in my book, it's really two tracks. It's both what your body can do as you change, you know, the fitness level of your muscles, but also your brain's capacity to activate these muscles to achieve balance and functionality. So as I explained in the book, much of what we do is not just to do a particular exercise, but as I like to say, actually engage your brain in problem solving. Just like once you learn to ride a bike, you can always ride a bike. The more we try and challenge our brain to figure out how to use our bodies in ways we haven't before, the more we expand our body's ability to move in different healthy, functional ways.
How do you challenge your brain to move your body? So you have a graphic, and maybe this is part of it, representing potential versus actual fitness through years. So it shows an obvious decline as we age, but I think you're saying we don't have to have it be like that.
That's right. It's interesting because so many people assume that they've peaked, you know, back in their 20s. And if you look at our potential fitness, sure, that's right. In terms of our capacity to be fast, to be strong, to have endurance, that does top out, research tells us, somewhere in mid to late 20s. But that's usually not where most of us were at that time. You know, I know with my life, I was nowhere near where I should have been at that point for whatever reason. In most of our lives, there are distractions. There's a lack of maybe access or time to be able to do these things that keep you fit. But the difference between the reality we had back then and the potential we had is what I call the fitness gap. And as we get older, the potential starts to decline little by little, decade by decade, but where we are can shift around. So for many of us, as we get older and we start taking care of ourselves a little bit more, start engaging in exercise, start taking care of our nutrition, start trying to be healthier in many ways, we can actually end up being in a healthier spot than we were back in our 20s and, in fact, narrow that gap. So even as the potential might decrease little by little, our actual fitness can start raising up to the highest level. So I've seen people and clients of mine in their 60s, 70s, who are actually in the best shape of their lives. Now, maybe if they'd been doing all these same things back in their 20s, they, of course, would have been even more fit. But I just love the idea that whenever you decide to become fit, you can improve and perhaps even become the best you've ever been. That's a great encouraging message, I think.
Oh, I think it is too. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jeff Horowitz. He is the author of Ageless Strength, Strong and Fit for a Lifetime, which is what I think we all want to be. Let's talk a little bit about your three-part program. So when you open the book, you do have a beginning, but then you break it into balance, strength, and function, three different parts. I think most of our listeners are cyclists. They're at all levels from recreation to pro. And many, if not most, are also over 40. And just as you said, you can see people making these gains in their 60s and 70s. How does your program change the way we age? So does your program address the fact that as we get older, you can change the program to meet what goes on with you?
The book is basically based on that premise. And I should say that I'm an avid long-distance cyclist myself. I love doing Grand Fondos, and I've done multi-day events. And so cycling is near and dear to me. And as an endurance athlete, I see that as we get older, there are certain challenges that come up. Now, these are some of the same things that occur to us when we're younger, too. But as we get older, it comes more to the fore. So in terms of strength, when we're younger, our body's busy, you know, building muscle, regenerating, repairing, healing. Our balance is usually quite good. And as a result, our functionality is good. We can move in ways that are similar to how we move in real life. And then when we do these movements in real life, we're going to apply strength and balance to it. So we can move quite easily and effectively when we're younger. As we get older, these things become more of a challenge. So the exercise I present in the book to meet these challenges are probably things we should be doing all through our lives, but they just become even more important as we get older. So, for example, as we start to age, we start to lose muscle mass. Our body stops producing as much testosterone and human growth hormone as we sleep. Our body doesn't repair quite as well as it used to. As a result, we start losing a little bit of muscle mass and a little bit of strength decade by decade. Also, as we get older, our inner ear function starts to decrease slightly. As I was saying, our strength decreases slightly. So our balance starts becoming a little less reliable. And as a result of these things, our functionality, our ability to move in ways that, you know, that are complex, like in real life, shoveling snow, being able to climb stairs, put away boxes, carry things, that starts to decrease. So in my book, In Age of Strength, I try and meet these three challenges head on and address them so that we can delay the onset of these losses or in some cases even reverse them and maintain that kind of ability well into our later years.
I wanted to ask something about breath work, breathing. You know, I use a lot of breath work in yoga, and it helps to get people to move better because that's the focus. Do you incorporate any breathing technique into your programs?
You know, that's a great question, and now that you said that, I wish I had. I did not address that as a separate item in the book, and it's a great topic. And it's something that I know there's a lot of literature on it. It's something that you should bring to everything that you do. As a runner, it's taken me quite a while to actually be more efficient with my breathing and breathe correctly. Just like with running itself, you know, breathing is something we've obviously done as soon as we pop out of the womb. But most people aren't taught the correct ways to do it, especially as we demand more of our bodies through exercise and performance, cycling, different events. We don't think that much about breathing, but as you say, it's such a crucial aspect of what we do. So I would encourage all your listeners and all your clients to learn more about that and pursue that and bring that to everything you do, including the strength training that I talk about in Ageless Strength.
Okay, good. I agree. I totally agree. So
yes, what he said. That's
yeah,
right.
Right. What he said. So, one of the things that really is intriguing about your book is you say build fitness in an hour a week. And I know I retired in 2012, only I find myself busier than I've ever been in my whole life. I don't know where all this time goes. How are you able to get what you are looking for in terms of balance and strength and function in an hour a week?
You know, it's really about being efficient. One of the things I do with my new clients when I meet them in a fitness center is I have them look around the room and just notice what other people are doing. And if you do that, you realize that most people are not actually exercising. In fact, most of the time, if you look around the room in a crowded gym, you might be lucky to find one or two people out of 10 who are at that moment actually doing an exercise. So right off the bat, you have to recognize there's a lot of downtime that most people bring to their workout. They do an exercise, and they kind of wait to catch their breath, or they relax for a moment and recover some of their strength, and then they do another set, and then they rest again. And that kind of drives me a little crazy. I'm a native New Yorker, so I want everything to happen in a New York minute. And I'm very impatient with things. But I recognize, too, that even if one muscle group is fatigued, there are plenty of other muscle groups that are ready to go. So an hour a week represents really an hour of honest work. You know, it's like thinking about a ball game. If you actually took all the action in a ball game and compressed it, a ball game would probably last about 40 minutes or so, right? 30
right.
minutes. But it's all the waiting. And, you know, especially if you're talking about endurance athletes, like cyclists, you have this endurance base where you can maintain constant movement for an extended period of time. So I find when I have an endurance athlete who goes through this kind of workout, where you're nearly constantly doing an exercise, if you have a good solid endurance base, it's not that hard. In fact, it feels kind of familiar. You get that, you know, that elevated heart rate, so it almost becomes like a cardio exercise, and you start getting into the groove and you get warmed up. And for me, if I have too much downtime, I kind of lose my focus in it in a workout. The more I'm moving, the more I stay involved in the workout and the higher my energy levels. So that's one big aspect of it. Another thing, too, though, is to work effectively. So if you keep doing endless sets of an exercise, you're not really going to get a lot of benefit. The research shows that if you do one set where previously you had done nothing, you get huge benefit. If you do two sets, the benefits still increase. But after that, the law of diminishing returns set in, and you really don't get a lot more benefit by doing three, four, five sets of something. At that point, you think, after I've done two sets of an exercise, I should do something else and stress some other muscles. And that's a way of being very effective as well. So in the old days, I used to do these mammoth workouts, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. And I have to say, I don't think I was any more fit, in a lot of ways less fit, doing that kind of workout than I am now doing the kind of 30-minute workout that I outline in the book.
Well, it's interesting because you have a lot of really well-defined with pictures. So we have illustration here. Mm-hmm. Exercises, leg raises, crunches, hip thrusts, rollouts, standing shoulder presses, lateral raises. How much equipment would somebody need to be able to do what you are asking at home if they didn't belong to a gym?
That's a great question. And the answer is, everything that's outlined in the book, you should be able to do at home with a minimal amount of equipment. Some of it you can just improvise. I do recommend a couple of dumbbells, but you could always use, you know, water jugs, water-filled bottles. I do recommend buying things like a BOSU, a stability ball, things to increase the level of instability to make your core and balance sense work harder. But everything we do in the book could be done in your own bedroom, and that was very purposeful. I didn't really want any barriers to these exercises. If you have access to a gym, you obviously have a greater range of options. But what I did in the book is not only present 50 different exercises, but we scale it up different ways. So there are three levels of each exercise. We change something about the exercise to change the challenge. So in essence, there are about 150 exercises. And when you start putting together all the different combinations, you should never have to do two workouts in a row that are exactly the same. And the guiding principles that I use in the book are really twofold, pretty simple in a way. That one, we try to make it as complex as possible, so that way we engage our brain in solving, you know, the problem of movement, trying to figure out how to use your body, right? And two, try and make it as unstable, so as complex and as unstable as possible. When you make an exercise complex, you're really challenging your brain to figure out how to use all your different body parts in new and novel ways. And when you do that, you increase your functionality. Because in the real life, in the real world, you don't do isolation movements, right? You don't do like a simple arm curl. When you have to pick up a box or shovel snow or work in the yard, you're using your body in all kinds of ways, just like we did centuries ago. And that's what I want to get to now. And it's a much more functional, much more effective way of moving. And you don't need a lot of equipment to do that. You know, it's about learning how to use your body in kind of an interesting and effective way. And that could be done right in your own bedroom.
Well, it's a really well done and not complicated book, which I like. People can get into it and be able to start a fitness program as soon as they get the book. How can people get a copy of Ageless Strength, Strong and Fit for a Lifetime?
Thanks. You can go right to Velo Press, VELO.com. And also it's available on Amazon and probably your local bookstore. Certainly your running stores and cycling shops should carry them. And I know it's in Barnes & Nobles. And go online or go out to your favorite store.
Well, Jeff Horowitz, he's a certified running, cycling, and triathlon coach. He's a personal trainer. He's the author of several other books, Quick Strength for Runners, Smart Marathon Training, How to Run Your Best Without Running Yourself Ragged, which sounds really good. And this one, the new book, So Ageless Strength, Strong and Fit for a Lifetime. Thank you so much for talking with me today. Good luck with the book. We will post the information on our Facebook page. And stay fit.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
All right. You have a great day. Jeff Horowitz joined me from his home in Washington, D.C. Interesting conversation. The book, again, is Ageless Strength, Strong and Fit for a Lifetime. You can get it at the usual places. I'd also like to thank Tyler Evans from Firefly Bicycles and Mark Beaumont, who is about to take around the world 18,000-mile trip and set a new record. Thank you so much for listening this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist next week. And don't forget, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.